If you have amore for a great cup of coffee like I do, then I have good news. Everyone knows that the key to making the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But there's no way to know when most coffee was roasted, which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that this coffee is delivered to your home or office within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. You will taste the difference. So don't throw your life down the toilet! Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. And action!
Hello, Moon in Your Eye movie people, and thank you for checking out the next 100 Project. 123 AFI movies later, and here we are, having covered nearly 50 more random flicks. And in all these flicks, we spoil. I'm the pizza pie-eyed Ryan Ellis, and my face-slapping wife is Bev.
Snap out of it!
I will not snap out of it. Hit me again. So we're back from vacation. We had a good time. We're all rested up. We're tanned.
Feeling good.
Staying tanned at the same time.
Sobered up for the first time, you know, in a week to come here and bring you this podcast.
Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Moonstruck. Cher has acted in a mere 15 movies in her entire career, theatrical movies. She only worked with one director more than once in those 15 flicks. Who's that director?
She barely worked in two of his films, but it was Robert Altman.
Yeah.
She was the lead in Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, which I had never heard of before I looked this up. And then she did a cameo as herself in The Player.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch, actually, because it's not a character she's playing. Mm. Many people in that movie are playing themselves, and she was one of them. As for Jimmy Dean, I saw that because I think I've now seen everything he's ever made, certainly everything since Smash. Mm. It was a point I made when I had the Zip account. Americans won't know what that is, but Canadians will recognize that as the...
It's like Canadian Netflix when they mailed DVDs
yes,
to
you. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he was one of the guys I made sure to see all the movies for, and that was one of the ones I rented, and it was pretty solid. It was more of a stage play. It was a stage play. They turned into a movie. And yeah, that was one of her first films, too. Well, she'd been probably a few things before that, but that was helping to put her on the map.
I mean, she did the TV show, but it is incredible that she was only in 15 films. When you look at her career, she has some damn good movies on that list, or at the least... A lot of pretty good movies. And there's, like, Burlesque. But, yeah. Whatever.
Which is her last movie, isn't it?
I think so. I can't think of any movie she's been in since.
And that was quite a few years ago. We're talking like she's dead or retired, but she hasn't made a movie in a long time, and she maybe won't. She's not exactly 43 anymore, or 23, or even 63, I don't think, right?
Well, I mean, her main job is, of course, a performer. She's a singer, so I think she still tours.
And she's rich enough to do nothing if she wants to.
Yeah.
Okay, the next 100 Project's 47th motion picture, Moonstruck, was indeed nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, unsuccessfully. After some November premieres, MGM released the picture in December 1987, which makes this a 30-year-old movie, or almost 30 years old at least. And like I said a few weeks ago in promoting this one, this will be the first of several 1987 movies we will cover in 2017. Critics said nice things, and crowds helped make it a juicy hit. Bev, explain for people who forget what the movie's about with the skinny.
Well, Cher is Loretta Castorini, an Italian-American accountant living in Brooklyn, with her mother Rose, played by Olympia Dukakis, father Cosmo, played by Vincent Gardenia, and grandfather, played by, I'll say this wrong, Fyodor Chaliapin. I'm sure that an Italian somewhere is cringing from the inside out by
you
that.
You forgot the junior.
I forgot the junior, yes. There's a senior Fyodor Chaliapin somewhere. I'm sorry. After settling for...
He's probably dead. They're both probably dead.
Oh, surely he's probably dead. After settling for an engagement to Mama's boy, Johnny Camerari, played by Danny Aiello. I didn't do very much better with Danny Aiello, did I?
I heard it. It was good enough.
She has the misfortune of falling madly in love with his wild, passionate brother, Nicolas Cage's Ronnie.
Or, in a nutshell, accountant sets record by betraying fiancé less than 24 hours after marriage proposal. I mean, really, it's the next day when she's banging Ronnie. Not cool, Cher/Loretta. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 92% of critics like the movie. That's a lot. 47 fresh and 4 rotten. 80% of audiences, though, considerably fewer. And it was a strong fifth at the 1987 U.S. box office. Three Men and a Baby was the smash hit that year. Leonard Nimoy directed that movie, for those who forgot that he also directed Star Trek movies, of course, but did Three Men and a Baby.
I loved that movie when it came out, and I was 9.
It's charming. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it's okay. Okay, but back to Moonstruck. What did you think of, well, it's one of your favorites. Obviously liked it, so let's hear your more in-depth thoughts.
So, I know I've said this before, but here it is. Romantic comedies must be among the hardest genres to pull off well, because there are so many failures. But when it's done right, it's amazing. And when you get the rare, near-perfect rom-com like Moonstruck, it's just joy incarnate. This film leaves me buoyant. I love it so much. It's so wonderful. Oh, you disagree.
I've seen it, I guess, 3 times.
Oh, it's going to be like this, is it?
I saw it a long time ago, and I think I've seen it with you at least once since we've been together. And now this time. It wouldn't be a strong thumbs down, but I think it's a thumbs down.
I'm going to slap you in the face for real right now.
I got to snap out of my...
Snap out of it!
My disapproval of this film. I didn't dislike it in that way. It was more that I didn't buy... Maybe the fact that she bones a guy the next day after this other guy proposes. She obviously doesn't love Johnny. Let me get these names mixed up properly, right? Johnny and Ronnie. But she doesn't know anything about Ronnie, and I wouldn't say he really woos her. He doesn't earn it. He just takes her to bed, and she, oh, back of the hand to the forehead, and she just goes off with him. I would maybe buy that if it was built a little bit better. And then I would even forgive that, because you could argue they're just made for each other. Okay, fine. But then the ending, when everybody ends up in that kitchen, and it is very similar to a movie you hated in this one way, Swing Time, where when she tells Johnny that she... Well, actually, she doesn't even do that. I can't marry you, Loretta. My mother will die. Everybody, not just those three people that's benefits, everybody's happy because the mother says, you can't be with that woman anymore. And it is funny when Cosmo stands up and pounds his fist on the table. Okay, good laugh. But he's not just going to stop because she says, you can't do this anymore. Everything works out too perfectly. And that's what I didn't buy.
And you're not really criticizing that it has a happy ending. You're more like, they didn't sell it.
Yeah.
Okay. And we've complained in many a rom-com that we've seen, a lot of romantic comedies end with the right man stopping the wedding to the wrong man. Like in Swing Time, like in It Happened One Night, like in Philadelphia's Story.
Oh, yeah.
We've always made fun of that the groom that was supposed to marry our heroine is always totally A-okay with getting ousted for the other guy. And this is definitely another example where Johnny, you know, seems a little shell-shocked, but he's not that heartbroken to discover that his brother has swooped in and stolen his girl from him.
So she was being disloyal, as I point out in the nutshell. And maybe he puts that together later. You could argue it's only been a matter of minutes that he walks into that kitchen before the credits are rolled. But when he says, I can't marry you because my mother will die, when I went there and I said that I was going to get married and she was resurrected.
Yeah, started cooking for everyone in the house.
Okay, now remind me, why does he not get married to her then?
Okay, they never really make it super clear, and I had just assumed he's such a mama's boy that the only reason he proposed to Loretta was because his mother was dying, and he panicked that he didn't have a woman in the world that loved him and wanted to take care of him. And then when his mother's gonna live, he's like, well, I don't need to get married anymore. But then I've read it's because he thought it would be bad luck. He thought if he married Loretta, it would put a curse on his mother, and she would die, like, playing with all the superstition that they have in the rest of the film. But to me, right, it's just like, he's such a mama's boy. And he never really loved Loretta either.
No, it's true. He doesn't have a right to be that heartbroken, except he's got a right to be pissed off that his woman was cheating on him the very next day. He probably wouldn't know that detail, but that bothers me too. I'm supposed to be buying this relationship between these two people. Now, this is one thing I don't have a problem with, but I will bring it up. Cher has got 17 years on Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
Which is actually cool, because we've talked about it plenty in the movies we've even watched. And there are thousands of movies we've never watched where the man has got 20 or 30 or even 40 years on the woman. The Omen, which we did last October, that's an example where the male star is much older than the co-star, the female co-star.
In most romances, period, the male co-star is far older, at least by a decade.
No, not most. It doesn't happen that often. It happens more than it should.
And you get more extreme age differences that are never even acknowledged.
Well, the older woman is rare. That I agree with, and that's one thing that's good about this. But I don't think they have enough time in the movie to have great chemistry. The only time they really have true chemistry is when they go to the opera. And that sequence is fine. It's actually a nice little detail that a guy who doesn't look like an opera fan in any way is an opera fan.
Okay, so I'm going to defend it. And I'll acknowledge first, I first fell in love with this movie when I was like 10 years old. So I certainly would have forgiven it a lot back then. And then it just kind of imprinted itself on my brain, as movies do when you're young. So it never even dawned on me to question that strongly that they fall in love. But Here's my argument for why they do have chemistry. They have chemistry because they fight. That's certainly a trope in romantic comedies. Anyways, they fight, they kiss.
Everyone in this movie's fighting,
but actually. Everyone in this movie's fighting. So she's with Johnny, and they never bicker, and they always agree, and she just kind of takes care of him, and it's boring. But her family is the way she is with Ronnie, so it actually makes sense that she would have more chemistry with somebody who fights back, who's spirited. She wants to boss someone around. You know, she wants to be bossy, she wants it to be combative, because that's how she sees love. And her family very much love one another, which is why they can be so constantly cantankerous around to each other. It's this funny dynamic that the whole family has. That's probably where the chemistry comes from. That's how she always interprets love, is combative, is spirited. But I totally agree, it happens crazy fast. They get engaged within days of meeting one another. It's absurd.
That's happened in a lot of movies.
Yeah, in a Hollywood, like only a Hollywood romance would have a couple get engaged that quickly.
And that's more in the old movies back in the swing time. It happened when I had era where they would get engaged after a couple of days or a couple of hours sometimes.
And when I let myself think about it, the idea of them having a happy marriage, holes start getting punched in this very quickly, that their marriage is probably doomed. I mean, they have a really messed up start. And like you say, she's cheating on her fiance. He's sleeping with her. It almost seems like out of revenge to his brother. That he wants to take his brother's bride the way his bride was taken.
But then that's also bogus, too. That could have been written better than it was, that he's blaming his brother for what happened to his hand and then losing the woman because he turned his attention away.
That's, I guess, the bad blood. I know that's
supposed to be that's supposed to be the joke, but it's not all that funny. And it isn't certainly believable. Again, I'm going to go with the believable path.
But he ain't no monument to justice. This is going to happen through the whole podcast. Get used to it.
You were quoting a lot during the movie, and I didn't want to make you stop, but a few times I didn't know what they were saying because I didn't know the movie that well. The other question I got to ask, a reasonably good question, I guess I only have one this time. Even with this brotherly rift, they do work together. They run that bakery. Loretta's been with Johnny for a little while. How could Loretta have never met or even heard about Ronnie until the night that Johnny proposes?
What makes you think that Johnny works at the bakery? I don't think he does.
It says, what are the last
names? It's Camerari Brothers.
Yeah, right.
But they named the characters Camerari because they found that bakery and left everything exactly as it was.
The movie implies that they worked there, though. Both worked there.
But maybe there's another brother. Maybe was brothers and then he stopped working there.
Working too hard to defend this.
I don't think that they work together. I don't think that Johnny works at the bakery. He doesn't seem like a baker at all, anyway.
I think the movie's saying that, it's supposed to be.
Crazy when you meet Ronnie and he's wearing that wife beater and he's all sweaty and manly, you know, shoveling coal into the oven. You talk about the age difference. It's hard to believe he was only 23 when they shot
the movie.
He's
just a kid, yeah.
He looks way older.
He was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 82. He looks like he's about the same age as those kids, but then most of them look older than they're supposed to because kids in movies like that usually do. 5 years later, and he fits in with the adults even more when he's actually with adults, because, of course, in that other movie, he was with kids. This is a movie that probably should have been longer than it was. It's about an hour and 42 minutes, I think. And I didn't want to watch a two-hour rom-com. When they're that long, they're usually too long. But this one would have benefited from more development between not just those two characters, our two main ones, but also between Olympia Dukakis and John Mahoney. The guy gets a few drinks thrown in his face, he meets up with her, they have this chemistry that night, and then she cock-teases him. Not that she actually really does, I'm just making fun of the scene, I guess. But then you never see him again, and presumably she won't go anywhere near him again because she did have some interest in him, I think. But then she wants to be loyal to her husband, and then if Cosmo's going to go, okay, then I guess they're going to stick it out. Then the question becomes, well, why is John Mahoney in the movie at all?
I have a defense for that. I don't feel like his scene is too short. I think that it's really interesting, and really the scene's about her, not about him, although...
Yeah, I think it's an excuse to get her more screen time, and she is the best thing in the movie. She steals the whole thing.
She's amazing.
Definitely the funniest thing in the whole movie.
And she won an Oscar for it, you know? Mm-hmm. Apparently Norm Jewison, first screening of it, told her right then, this is going to win you an Oscar, and she was like, get out of here. Mm-hmm. He was right. So that scene, which I think is a great scene, and it's not just because it gives her a moment to... She needs to be reminded that she's desirable. He says this speech that perfectly encapsulates the theme of the film, or at least its view of love, and it's the speech where he talks about what it's like when his students just look at them with their innocent eyes, and everything he says is just so brilliant and smart, and all the ways that he's boring and lame, they just don't realize. What he's really summing up is how the real rush of love isn't how you feel about the other person. The real rush of love is that other person's reflection of yourself that you're falling in love with. He falls in love with the way they see him. She's mildly, temporarily infatuated with John Mahoney's character because the way he sees her, and she so desperately needs to be reminded that there's a man in the world that could find her attractive and want to take her home to his apartment. But she doesn't do it because I know who I am. And the great way to sum it up, the reason Cosmo was having an affair, you know, she's desperate trying to figure out why he's cheating on her, and she says it's because they fear death or whatever, but I think it's kind of because he's like a big baby himself, like Johnny Camerari. He needs that validation so bad. Just like Perry, John Mahoney's character, they need to go out and find women to make them feel attractive and valuable. Oh. But she's stronger than that. She's just a tougher broad. She knows who she is. She feels confident enough in herself that she doesn't need to risk her marriage and risk ruining her family to be reminded of it.
I do think a lot of cheating happens, at least on the male side, because of that exact thing. It isn't necessarily a conscious decision, but subconsciously, I got to be validated. And if it is a younger person that's coming after you because you've got some kind of influence like a teacher would, or somebody with money, then it's even easier and it's even more affirming. If you go after somebody who's the same age as you, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's more impressive to your ego if it's a younger, beautiful woman or just a younger person at all, I guess.
And while Mona, the woman that Cosmo's having the affair with, doesn't seem to be younger than him, she's definitely childish.
Or maybe the better thing to say is that she seems to need him. And I think one thing that does happen in a lot of marriages, I'm talking real marriages now, not just movie marriages, when people get older and established, the man, and the woman can feel this too, for sure, or two men, two women, whatever the relationship is, you've been together long enough, you start feeling like, they don't need me anymore, but this new person does.
Mm-hmm. And Olympia Dukakis, Rose, is incredibly self-reliant. That woman is tough as nails. But she does need him, and maybe that's why he softens at the end, because she has that vulnerability, and she looks at him and says, have I been a good wife? And te amo. And that beautiful vulnerability in the presence of all their family. And maybe that's what softens him and reminds him that it's going to be okay and that his marriage can recover from this. Although she really could give him a way harder time than she does.
Yeah. And there's all this stuff online about how that last scene took them a lot of time to prepare, rehearse it and all that stuff. Jewison had to figure out where to put the camera. But I don't know that they have it. And I guess I've already made this point. Because there's too much neat little packaging going on there. A pretty little package.
That scene to me is joy incarnate. By the time that scene starts, and I'm always so invested in the movie by the time it starts, I get so excited because it's my favorite. It just makes me so happy. But like I said, this could be because it made that impression on me when I was young enough to not really critically think about the movies I was watching. And so, like anybody with nostalgia movies, they just forgive those silly things that you probably should give them a hard time
for. I'm going to give you that slack because I'm going to compare it to the same era. It would have been a couple years before Moonstruck in 87. Rocky IV. Maybe all the Rocky sequels, especially the later ones. But Rocky IV is both one of the worst movies of that year, and to my childlike brain, one of the best.
So many people love Rocky IV, like kind of ironically, but not really ironically.
It's so silly.
There has to be something about it.
And it's also hole poke worthy, more so than Moonstruck, actually. And maybe we're doing the whole cliche thing of the guy who likes the action movie with the guys beating each other up, and the woman who likes the love story.
Possibly. Listen, I really fit into that cliche. I could care less about Rocky movies.
You've liked lots of movies that aren't the typical quote-unquote girl movie, and I've liked lots of movies that aren't the typical quote-unquote guy movie.
Fair enough. But I don't care about Rocky. Maybe if I'd seen it when I was younger.
Didn't you like Creed?
I liked it. I kind of forgot about it as soon as I finished it, though. All I really think about it, when I think about it, is Michael B. Jordan is amazing. Mm. His performance is the only thing that really left a lasting impression on
me. If you knew the Rocky series, you'd be more impressed by how good Stallone is. I think Stallone's best work in the entire series, including the first movie, is in Creed. But that's not the podcast we're doing here. We're doing Moonstruck. It's a very New York film. And unlike Royal Tenenbaums, which we covered a couple weeks ago, this is a travelogue. Much like Woody Allen's Manhattan, New York is all over this thing.
Even though a bunch of it was shot right here in Toronto.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, Mean Streets, I happened to watch that a few days ago, and of course that's supposed to be this ultimate New York movie, one of Scorsese's first movies ever, and I think the first one that's blatantly set in New York, maybe his earlier films that most people haven't seen were, but this one put him on the map. It's all about New York, and yet most of it was shot in L.A. Good Will Hunting is this big Boston movie, and yet the majority of it was shot here in Toronto, like you said. There's a lot of running themes in the film. One of them would be the moon shots. There are more shots of the moon than in a werewolf movie.
Yeah, the original title of the movie was The Bride and the Wolf, but Jewison fought to change it to Moonstruck because the moon just winds up playing such a big role in the film.
Well, Bride
La Luna, La Luna!
Bride and the Wolf is mentioned quite a few times, though, and there's even that analogy that somebody gives. So it would have been an appropriate title had they stuck with Brian the Wolf.
Ronnie's character is supposed to be the wolf. Nicolas Cage, who is notoriously wacky, even at the age of 23, actually played it with a growl in his voice and was trying to talk like a wolf until, you know, the dailies started coming back and Jewison was like, cut it out. Apparently talking about actors to replace him because he was fighting them on it, and then he came around.
And Cher fought for him because they didn't want to cast him in the first place, and then I guess you're saying they would have actually fired him. Nicolas Cage, the same year he did Raising Arizona, that might find its way into your downloaded Top 100 Project / Next 100 Project folders sometime soon. Won the Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, and another movie we really should cover this year is Adaptation. But we don't even see him in this film until 25 minutes in. I always find that interesting when you think about the romantic comedies, or you think about movies with two great antagonists or two people in a love story. Fargo, you don't see Frances McDormand until about 33 or so minutes in, and now you got a guy in a movie who isn't even there until almost half an hour.
I want to read a quote. Chris Chase from, I want to say, New York Magazine wrote this. "People keep being surprised that Cage, who's only 23, is such a terrific actor. Maybe you have to be 23 to have that combination of wildness and earnestness work for you. It might look foolish on an older fellow." Which is pretty prophetic, because nobody has any time for Nicolas Cage's wackiness anymore.
I was saying to a friend a few days ago that there are probably more movies by him on Netflix than any other person. And I didn't actually do the science on this. I don't know how you'd find this out. I guess Netflix would have to tell us that. But I just searched him later that night, and I think it was 12. Which is a lot of movies for one actor, but then a ton of those are movies that people have not seen or even heard of that he's done the last few years to pay off those infamous debts he has. But he doesn't really phone it in very much. You got to give him that much through so much of the crap he's done. John Cusack. Everyone loves John Cusack. No one's ever said a bad word about that guy, at least publicly. He's done more Drek in the last few years than Cage has, and he hasn't been in a good movie in even longer than Cage has, I think.
He was such a rising star. He belongs to Hollywood royalty. He's a Coppola, who changed his name. His name is Nicholas Coppola. Coppola, I always say it wrong. Coppola, right?
Coppola.
Thank you. He changed his name from Coppola to Cage because he didn't want the nepotism, but I'm sure he got plenty of nepotism regardless.
Well, he was in Peggy Sue Got Married by his uncle, Francis Coppola.
Yeah, right. He was relatively young when he won that Oscar. He had had a few great parts. So the bar was set really high for him. When did he cross the line? I'm trying to think. To me, it was immediately after he won the Oscar and he just started making one dumb action movie after another. But people love The Rock.
I love The Rock.
People even love Con Air.
And a lot of people love Face Off. Those are the three action movies you're talking about.
Yeah, but then after that, it's Snake Eyes.
Yeah, but also Adaptation is 2002.
Oh, yeah.
Matchstick Men is 2003. That's underrated. And he did something else in the 2000s I can't think of right now. But I know when I looked, he did three movies in the 2000s that I thought were either very good or even great. Not a terrific track record, but even Tom Hanks in the 2000s was not as automatic as he had been before, and certainly Cruise wasn't. So, anyway, I don't want to spend another 20 minutes going on the whole Nicolas Cage is underrated or hacked on too much.
He has a pretty bad reputation for being a jerk on set.
Well, I can buy that.
Not compromising ever or working with a director, so that could be part of it too.
Let's get to another actor, Danny Aiello. Johnny gave us the blueprint for how to propose. Don't come with a ring. Don't want to get down on your knees. When you do, you have no idea what to do with it. Kind of funny, though, at least.
This is a good suit. I know. I helped you pick it out. It came with two pairs of pants. Get on your knees.
I like that going across, 2 feet is going to wreck the knees in the suit. How weak is that material that it would ruin the suit that quickly? And did you notice some foreshadowing? After the proposal, the very next scene, they're in a car, and Loretta is the one who's driving. I think that's a metaphor. She's in the driver's seat with this relationship.
Well, she's driving him to the airport.
I know, but in movie terms, that matters. The very next scene, she's driving. You don't see women drive in movies all that much, unless they are in charge of something.
And this is a very traditional family. Mm-hmm. Even though, her and her mom are the boss, they definitely are pretty in-charge ladies.
All right, so as for the most famous line in the whole movie, snap out of it! That requires context. It made the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. It was 96th. I don't think it's a good quote unless you see the whole scene, or at least more than just the snap out of it. A lot of the quotes stand on their own, maybe because they're so famous. They're on the quotes list or just in your memory from the Casablanca screenplay or from you name it. All the great quotes have ever been in movies. Rosebud, everyone knows what that means if they know Citizen Kane at least. But when you watch the scene with the whole, I'm in love with you. Now, does she slap him and then she snap out of it and slap him again? She slaps him twice, which is really important. One slap wouldn't be as funny, but the two slaps and the snap out of it after I'm in love with you, that's what should be the whole quote. But of course, on the list, it's just snap out of it.
Yeah, because he's so persistent that she just keeps slapping him. He's looking her dead in her eyes and insisting he's in love with her.
But the real love in this movie, from Bev's point of view, the old man and the dogs.
Oh my god, they're the best. La luna, Ricardo, la luna.
I was looking down, taking a note at one point, and you were laughing your ass off, and I didn't know why. And we rewound the movie because one of the dogs takes a header into the stairs. Great happy accident.
Oh my god. Old man, if you give those dogs another piece of my food, I'll kick you till you're dead. I should have made the quotes list. Oh, he's so cute. And then at the end, when he's crying, what's the matter, Pop? I'm confused. He gets the best lines.
He should
lines
be. It's very confused.
Oh,
no, she gets
it.
The best lines in the movie.
True, true.
He gets the best lines for the supporting players, maybe. Well, I guess she's supporting, but she's more of a main character than supporting. The only other big role that Olympia Dukakis has that I can see in her resume is Steel Magnolias. But she's been acting for 65 years. In fact, a lot of these actors now have been acting for a very long time. Vincent Gardenia was a character actor for 45 plus years. He was in The Hustler, which we covered last year. He might be the bartender in the opening scene that makes the dumb bet when Paul Newman's playing like he's drunk, but isn't really. Makes the shot, and then they go into the credits. As for Cher in one of her 15 movies, the other three that I think are really noteworthy are Silkwood, which really helped put her on the map, which is Beastwick, with Nicholson, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Susan Sarandon.
Love her.
Mask in between Silkwood and these other two movies, where I think maybe gives the best performance out of any of these. You love Moonstruck, and that's fine, and she wasn't unworthy of winning the Oscar that year, although I would have given it to Holly Hunter in Broadcast News.
Mm-hmm.
But she might have been more worthy in Mask, and she wasn't even recognized with a nomination of that, and I heard she was pissed about that. She actually thought she was bad in this movie, and she even said so to Dukakis, or give her a look or something like that. Like, oh, this is a stinker.
Yeah, she tried to turn it down. She didn't think that she could pull off the whole Italian-American thing, although her accent's like 1,000% convincing.
John Patrick Shanley, the writer, we don't think we even said his name yet, he wrote it for Sally Field.
Really?
Who was the lead in Steel Magnolias with Olympia Dukakis.
Wow. Irish writer, Jewish director, certainly some Italians in the cast, but considering it's such an Italian-American movie, there really aren't that many Italians in the big jobs.
Cage.
Danny Aiello and...
Gardenia,
yeah.
I think they do a good job of glamming down Cher until they glam her back up.
She said she liked playing that part better.
Where she's glammed down?
Yeah, she liked the first half where she was just dowdy old widow Loretta.
Well, she's not... Oh, that's right, she's a widow. We didn't mention that yet. She's been married before, which she brings up many times. She doesn't look bad at any point in the film, but Cher's not exactly one of those incredible beauties either, so when they have her looking worse, it's believable. She looks like a regular person more so than she ever would in probably any other movie role she's ever had.
She's dressed with those high collars, like very modestly. She ties her hair back, which is probably one of her best assets, and kind of hides her figure. She kind of looks like an old lady, and she kind of acts like an old lady too. It seems like she's given up on that youth and that vibrance. And then when it blooms, when it comes back, it's such a big transformation.
You've seen Broadcast News, right? Do you
yeah.
agree with me that Hunter was probably more worthy than Cher?
I need to see it again. It's been a while, and I've seen Moonstruck many times. It feels like Hunter's, it was probably a harder role to do. It's probably like a harder thing to pull off, to be the person she is and still be likable and root forable. Although, you know, we're talking about Moonstruck, a movie where she's cheating on her fiance with his brother, and we still root for her.
I think Cher also won for the whole body of work thing, even though she hadn't been acting that long. She'd been good in Silkwood and been good in Mask, which is Beastwick, was that same year. And then her career was Sonny Bono before that. So she probably was winning it also on reputation as much as that one role. That has happened at the Oscars so many times. Well, the guy who's been to the Oscars many times with nominations and has never actually won for directing is Norma Jewison, who is now 90 years old. He's still alive, but he's not working anymore. His last movie was The Statement in 2003. Good old Canadian boy, and doesn't live too far from here, as far as I understand it. We covered him in The Heat of the Night, which won Best Picture in 1967, but he didn't win for Best Director. He also did so many other movies. I guess Fiddler on the Roof is one of his more major ones, a big hit, and also got
Jesus
him
Christ,
a couple
superstar.
Nominations.
Yeah.
Right. We could rattle off his resume for a long time. He's covered a lot of genres, too. He's one of those guys that does sci-fi, futuristic movies like Rollerball, even. 2 weeks ago, our last podcast was Kill Bill with a true auteur of modern cinema, Quentin Tarantino. As good as Norma Jewison is, he's a workmanlike director. What did you think of his work in this film?
Someone summed it up for me really well once and said that he's as good as the people he's working with. He is a good director, but when he has a great script and a great cast and great crew working with him, he can make something that's lightning in a bottle, like In the Heat of the Night or Moonstruck, in my opinion. But he's made lots of films that are just good.
I would put him in the same category with acting, though, with Spencer Tracy. Well, Spencer Tracy in his business is a bigger player all time than Jewison is in his business. But I said it about Spencer Tracy, and guess who's coming to dinner? We covered him. as good as he was at so many movies, I don't think one movie, not performance, but one actual film he was in was great. A lot of very good ones. And Jewison, that's probably true of him, too.
I'll say this for Norm Jewison. Before I went into TV, I worked in film, and that man has a platinum reputation in this country, in Canada. Canada needs a hero as far as the film industry goes. It's kind of pathetic, and it's very hard to get talent to stay and to get money to make feature films. But he has helped fund a school for filmmakers and has always been a great patron of filmmaking in Canada. Everybody who's ever met him just has nothing but exceptional, lovely things to say about him.
He's the unofficial host of the TIFF every year, too. Mm-hmm. He has people up to his farm, ranch, where the hell it is, north of Toronto, for dinners and lunches, I guess, at least once during the TIFF. His writer was John Patrick Shanley, who later did Joe vs. the Volcano, and then many years later did Doubt. He also directed both of those movies. I have doubt. The screenplay won the Oscar, along with Cher and Olympia Dukakis. Debatable choice for that award. But what did you think of the writing of it? What did you think of the tone of it? The tone's more about Jewison, actually.
So who should have won Screenwriting Award that year, then?
Well, original screenplay, I guess Broadcast News was original. I think it was nominated. Should have been that.
You think it's that much better than Moonstruck Broadcast
News?
Not
that much better, but I think you got a problem here. Hey, we're talking about tone, actually. That's more on Jewison than it is on Shanley. I don't buy the ending. I don't really buy the relationship that Cage and Cher have to begin with. So that's on both the writer and the director.
There's so many great lines. There's so much amazing, dialogue fiery is really good. Dialogue. A writer would love this script. It's so well done. You asked me about tone. I think that's one of the things that make this movie amazing. Tone is one of those underrated things that people don't ever take into account. What makes a great film? Being consistent. And Moonstruck is this masterpiece of tone. It's warm, it's easy, familiar, it's both fantastical with the moon stuff, but also no nonsense with Loretta and Rose. But most of all, it's consistent. There's nothing that happens that feels hard to believe. And as I'm saying that, of course you disagree. Maybe it's that I believe the characters, at the very least. Even if you find the circumstances hard to believe, I am totally invested that the characters know what they're doing and would behave like this. Even though, like, those beautiful little vignettes, like the old woman at the airport, or the bakery employee who confesses her love for Ronnie, it all fits in seamlessly to make this world that's part of the charm, this New York Italian-American world.
Okay. We can agree to disagree.
And, oh, here, okay, one more thing is the theme of the family. I mean, we haven't talked about this, but it's such an important part of the movie and so much of the charm. It's a love story between Loretta and Ronnie, but it's also just this illustration of family love. Like, I don't know if there's ever been a better illustration of a family that can bicker like that, where there's no attempt to truly hurt one another and nobody takes it personally, and they can express their anger and give each other a hard time only because they love each other, but they also trust one another so much, and they exude this uncommon comfort with each other. There's implicit trust that they can reveal their true selves, ugly or pretty, and always be loved, and always belong. Everybody who is in this world 100% belongs in this world.
Well, then, the last shot of the movie is the team photo, if you will. And guess who doesn't belong, but he's in, as you pointed out, the center of the picture, Johnny.
Oh, yeah, the picture that they show is just, like, a part of the press package, really. He's really well-featured, like, centered. Was he the biggest star, perhaps, when the movie came out? Cher is the biggest star. Yeah, she should be the
center
of the
photo. Even Cage had built up a name by that point in some smaller movies.
Yeah, Danny Aiello's never been an A-lister.
Well, he'd been in some Woody Allen movies before this, and he'd been in The Godfather Part 2. And then, of course, Do the Right Thing, which we covered, was a few years after this.
Yeah, he's barely a household name. Mm. Yeah, you're right. Do the Right Thing came out after this.
But maybe that's part of the point of this, is that we can even make this guy who's not really part of this family, well, I guess he would be if Ronnie does marry Loretta, he will be an in-law, but he's the centerpiece of this family, even though he clearly isn't the centerpiece of this particular family.
Yeah, he's not even really the centerpiece of the story of the film.
So I do think that's a bit of a mistake, too.
All right. Oh, come on.
So technically speaking, the movie's 1:85:1, but it actually was shot in what they call a Cagney ratio, meaning it's effectively a square picture. But we did see the 1:85:1 Blu-ray. Didn't look bad, but it didn't look as good as I thought it might. But then a lot of Blu-rays from the 80s, the 70s, and so on, unless they've been remastered, are mediocre. The cinematographer was David Watkin, who worked for 45 years. Chariots of Fire and Out of Africa are on his resume. I think he won an Oscar for Out of Africa. It's a movie we'll never watch because it's long, slow, and dull. The editor, Lou Lombardo, here's an interesting guy because he worked a lot with Sam Peckinpah and with a guy we mentioned earlier in this podcast, Robert Altman. And the music, Dick Hyman, who did movies, I mentioned Woody Allen a minute ago, did Zelig and the Purple Rose of Cairo scores. And there's a lot of other things where he was involved with music. I guess he was a singer a lot of the time, too. The most major song in this movie, of course, is the Dean Martin song, That's Amore, which is played more than once. The beginning and the ending, and then even during the film.
The whole score kind of works with that as a theme.
Yeah.
It's the same instruments.
So the awards in this section is the longest we've had in a very long time. The 3 Oscars for Best Actress for Cher, the Supporting Actress for Dukakis. And I gotta say, that was definitely the right choice.
Dukakis.
Seeing this again, she was really great.
Yeah.
And Shannon Lee's screenplay, 3 failed nominations, Best Picture, Best Director for Jewison, and Supporting Actor Vincent Gardenia. It was 96, as I said, on the Top 100 Quotes with Snap Out of It. 41st on the Top 100 Laughs. There's some good laughs. But unless you're a big fan like you, I don't think it's that funny.
Oh my gosh, you are so wrong.
Highly ranked for a comedy. 17th on the Top 100 Passions, and I will give you that one. The movie is filled with love, and it does express it very well. That's fine. It was 8th in the rom-com category of the Top 100 Genres.
You know, the evidence piling up against you here. A lot of people agree with me, is all I'm saying.
AFI does, that's for sure. It was also nominated for the Top 100 Songs, That's Amore. All right, then, final thoughts on Moonstruck.
Well, as much as I'm sad you disagree with me, it is pretty rare that you and I do a podcast where I like a movie and you don't, because I'm usually the naysayer of the two of us. Sometimes it's fun to argue about things, but my only complaint about Moonstruck is that it makes me want to dramatically lament to the pitiless moon about the depressing dearth of good romantic comedies in recent years. Why aren't there more masterpieces like this perfect film, perfect as a snowflake?
You feel that way, huh?
Yeah.
Then snap out of it! I slapped myself, I didn't hit her. Not a bad movie, just not great. I wanted it to be better than it was, and I hadn't seen it so long I had forgotten the things I had problems with. So when we check in with you again in 7 days on the Next 100 Project, we'll be peeking at our first animated movie in a very long time, and your fourth choice in the month of Bev. It is Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away. So the coming attraction trivia is very complicated. Let me lay this all out. Between Shrek, Finding Nemo, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Inside Out, The Lion King, and Spirited Away, which film has the highest scores on Rotten Tomatoes, which is the biggest U.S. hit adjusted for inflation, and which is the highest ranked on the IMDb? It could be the same film, it could be multiple films, but I bring up those ones because Shrek was a huge hit, Finding Nemo was even bigger, Snow White is maybe the all-time great animated film, Inside Out is one of the great more recent animated films, Lion King is one of the biggest hits of all time and also revered, and then Spirited Away, which is revered in a different kind of way because it isn't American.
Yeah, they're all films that are almost universally loved, but this could probably open up a great discussion for all the things that influence the Rotten Tomatoes ratings of a film, both expectations and finding the audience that should find it, stuff like that. All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered almost 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 07 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us and review us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend 51. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Well, I don't know about these guys, but I'm in love with you.
Snap out of it! Te amo, te amo.
Nice save.
And cut.